I think, a very lively and rich program to cover this afternoon. I first want to thank the many different people involved in pulling together the special issue of the Journal of AIDS and this event. From CSIS, Matt Fisher has been just prodigious and indefatigable in pulling all this together over many, many weeks, and I just want to single Matt out for a special thanks. The co-editors who are all here, and we'll be hearing from them in one form or another, Wafa El-Sadr, Tom Quinn, Paul Volberding, thanks to you. From OGAC, of course, we did this in partnership with OGAC, and we'll hear from Eric in a moment. Deborah von Zinkernagel, Joseph Fu, Rich Needle were with us all along in this process, and really we could not have undertaken this project were it not for their support throughout. And today, we have many different folks who've taken time out of a very, very busy schedule to be with us to lend their insights to our panels. I want to thank Mark Dybul, Tony Fauci. Eric will be with us on the first panel. Waffle will be joined by Alex Muganzi and Jeff Stringer. And then in our closing panel, Chris Beyer, Kevin DeCock, and David Sirwada. So I want to thank all of them. I hope you will have a chance to read the journal. I think it provides many, many insights. And we'll hear some of that referenced in the course of our discussions. We chose today to have this be more of a conversation and a roundtable style of discussion rather than pulling authors up and asking them to summarize their papers, but rather to take big topics, the strategic significance, what's been learned, what's the future look like, and jump off from there. I want to also draw to your attention that we have put together course materials into a consolidated form on iTunes University. If you have the iTunes University app on either your iPad or your iPhone, you'll find this event and many a multitude of other products, podcasts, written analyses, videos that have been assembled over the many months here on CSIS with reference to AIDS 2012. And additional input as we go through the week will be added in. And if you have that app, it'll be constantly renewed. Tomorrow morning, we'll be joined by Margaret Chan here and Tony Lake from UNICEF, Margaret Chan from WHO. Craig McClure from UNICEF has joined together in organizing a very ambitious program. Starts at 10 a.m., runs till 1, followed by a luncheon focused on pediatric PMTCT. We have a number of prominent African ministers of health joining us, and the leadership of many of the multilateral institutions, Michelle Sidibe, Gabriel Jaramillo, and others, and I believe Eric will be there with us. So please join us for that. And on Tuesday afternoon at 4:30 p.m., here in the same space, all of these events are here, we will have a book event at 4:30 p.m. for Peter Piot's No Time to Lose. For an hour, we'll have a conversation with Peter about that book, followed by a reception. So please join us for those two. And please give us any feedback on any of these events as they unfold by email or phone or the like. So those are just by way of introduction and welcome. We're thrilled that CSIS is able to play this partnership role across all of these different activities. We're very proud of what's happening here in our town, and we're very proud of what the U.S. government has been able to do, and that many of you in your different walks and organizations. And so with that, I'd like to ask Eric to come and deliver just a few opening remarks, and then we'll move to our first panel. Thank you. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. Just wanted to turn this on. I really appreciate the introduction and want to thank you and your team at CSIS for making this a successful launch event. It's really kind of over the top. It seems like the whole week is a little bit over the top for this, I'll tell you. For those of us who don't do this for a living, as opposed to, you know, my friend Tony Fauci, who's used to this at least many more times than me in terms of the frenzy of it, this is like really a different level of attentiveness. So. So. But I'd like to thank the guest editors, Wafa, Paul, Tom, and Steve, for the labor of love that they put into getting all of us corralled like cats into focusing on this and doing it, because everybody has more than a full-time job in your regular routine. And to fit this in, I know, was a real effort, but an effort that everyone put their brain and hearts into. And I want to tell you, as the current kind of captain of the PEPFAR ship, this really will be something that we use over and over again. So I do thank you for that. And I also thank you for the people who use these services. I want to thank the authors of the manuscripts for your thoughtful contributions to PEPFAR's development from the beginning. You were all there and intimately involved in a lot of the simple foundational constructs that began when President Bush launched this initiative. We're fortunate to have really a diverse range of authors, ranging from USG, implementers, civil society, government, academia, host country nationals, really a remarkable collection and compilation in this edition. All of it reflects the scope and diversity of what is truly a remarkable program. I want to thank you for taking the time to do the work, to write the articles, and to help us reflect our work to those who need to understand the impact of these programs and the need for them to continue. Most of all, I'd like to recognize the healthcare providers, faith-based organizations, the community groups, the businesses, and the people living with HIV in the countries where we work. This is all a shared responsibility, a shared effort, and I hope it will be an effort that continues to give and give and give many years into the future. Finally, I want to welcome you, the audience, the expert panelists joining us here today on the webcast. Thank you for taking time on what I believe is Saturday, it is, afternoon, to focus on the PEPFAR program on the eve of this extraordinary AIDS 2012 week. We see this conference as a key moment for the world to come together to really recommit to creating an AIDS-free generation. It's a shared global responsibility, and I believe by showing us how far we've come by the credible authors and contributors to these articles, we will be able to concretize that work and galvanize the global effort that needs to rise up to get it across the finish line. So, thank you very much.
So we are going to have a conversation here for the first portion of this, and then there will be opportunity with each of these panels to invite comment and questions from you. And we'll have folks here to bring microphones to you. We are videotaping this, and it will be posted on our website, on CSIS and on Smart Global Health fairly soon afterwards, early next week, and you'll be able to access it then. So this panel is really meant to start at the largest scope, and really to ask these three leaders who've been involved for some time in thinking about the macro significance of PEPFAR to really reflect what on the strategic significance of PEPFAR. And each of them comes from a biomedical and public health background. So we're asking them to move into a zone of interest around defining what is at stake here in terms of national interests. And that's really what we're trying to focus upon here. There's a whole spectrum of ways of answering the question of what are the US national interests that are served or advanced by an initiative that is so large and complex and so different, really, from what we've had in the history of our foreign assistance. There's hard security interests, and there are softer interests which push us into the area of ethical obligations and humanitarian commitments and the like. And we've had, over the course of the last decade, different approaches and different thinking around this. So I thought it would be very useful to kick off this afternoon's conversations by asking Eric and Tony and Mark their reflections on this. So let's begin then with the basics. And the basic question really is, has PEPFAR advanced U.S. national interests, in your view? And if so, in which specific ways, in which specific interests do you imagine that that has been the case? Let's start and ask each of you to kick off the discussion. Tony, would you kick this off, please?
Okay. I think it's in a multifaceted way. When I think of that question, I think of the United States is the world's superpower, and there are other superpowers. Being a superpower doesn't necessarily mean you show global leadership. I think what PEPFAR epitomizes for me in the national interest is the affirmation that we're showing global leadership, I think at its purest, in the sense of for humanitarian reasons and assuming what I consider, and not everybody does, our moral responsibility as a nation and as a people, even if we weren't a superpower, but our now clear mandate that we are to show the leadership to understand, as President George Bush told me and told Mark when we were discussing the beginning of PEPFAR, that we really do have a moral responsibility to do this. And to me, that is in our national interest. Mm-hmm. Because I remember years ago when I was young in school, I was hearing this terminology, the ugly American. And I couldn't figure out what that was about. And then it became clear when you think about some of the things that were associated with our country, that maybe unfairly, but in some cases justifiably, that terminology stuck. I think that it can all be summarized for me in a conference I was a few hours ago that Diane Havlier and Mark and others were leading on TB, HIV. A person from Uganda got up in the audience and said, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to make a comment that PEPFAR is the best thing that has ever happened to Africa. And, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but for somebody to say that made me really feel good to be an American. So to me, that's our national interest.
Tony, you and Mark both were very deeply involved in the initial formulation and thinking of this in cooperation, obviously, in very close cooperation with the White House at that time and others. Mark, how was it expressed at that time as to why we needed to do this as a national interest?
Well, first I would say it's more than in cooperation with the White House. It was at the direct orders of the White House. we were kind of working for them. So the expression is what Tony mentioned. The issue before us was not the national security interest in the way we talk about it, and I'll come to that in a second. The driving force for this was the moral responsibility. So I have never heard President Bush privately or publicly discuss PEPFAR, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the President's Malaria Initiative, the Women's Justice and Empowerment Initiative, the African Education Initiative. We focused on PEPFAR, but it was much broader than that. It was a much broader approach. Without saying to whom much is given, much is required. Now, he didn't come up with that. That actually comes from the Gospel of Luke. But he always says to whom much is given, much is required. And it was a deeply felt moral obligation, no matter what our budgetary situation was, that we had a responsibility because we were the wealthiest country in the world. But the more I talked with him over time, the more I saw that there was a second moral compulsion that underlay that humanitarian response to the death and suffering. And that was a visceral reaction because of his deep belief in the dignity and worth of every human life, his visceral reaction to people who were literally saying Africans were too poor and uneducated to do something as complicated as antiretroviral therapy. It just was appalling to him that people would say something that because people were born in a certain circumstance, somehow they were less capable, less talented, less innovative than we were. And to this day, he gets uncomfortable in his seat when people use language like that. Mm-hmm. I think we have to remember, for those of us who are around, at the Millennium Development Goals Summit, people were literally saying Africans couldn't do treatment, we shouldn't bother. So that's why there wasn't a Millennium Development Goal on treatment. And that kind of language, and the language around Africans being promiscuous, when in fact they have fewer sexual partners in a lifetime than Americans have, that kind of just paternalistic slander against a continent just rubbed him so viscerally. So I think it was a dual moral response, one about the humanitarian death, and the other that we are all equal in his eyes before God. We are all of equal dignity and worth. We all have the right to fulfill our human potential, and that AIDS was destroying that opportunity to fulfill people's potential and was actually creating a global sense of a whole population of remarkable people in a very slanderous way. So that's what drove the conversation. But then if you look at the original PEPFAR authorization, the first, you know, the finding section in the first authorization is filled with national security interests, national security international, right, which we'll come back to, I'm sure, in the conversation. So in the selling of it, as opposed to in the purpose of it, we went to, there was a lot of national security talk. There still is, appropriately. And I think we're actually on an upswing back. If you look at the reauthorization, there was actually very little of that national security language. It all kind of went away and moved to the moral argument. But I think, particularly in the tough budget cycles and where we are and where Congress is, where the American people are, we're seeing a shift back towards the security national interest. And I'm sure we'll come back to that. But from the beginning, it was really a fully moral responsibility and those two pieces of it. And that second piece has taken me a little bit longer to have come to see in more conversations with President Bush.
Just a 10-second affirmation of that, because I'm smiling to myself, because when PEPFAR first came out, the press were calling me up, because this was obviously such an exciting thing. Come on, tell us what the real motivation was about it. And I said, no, I'm telling the truth. It's exactly as Mark and I just said, oh, come on, Tony. You've always been straight with us. Tell us what the real motivation of it was. And I kept on saying, that's the real motivation of it.
Well, you know, in this period, there was a lot of discussion of both the moral ethical obligations and the stability and security dimensions, right? I mean, it was in January of 2000 that Vice President Gore and Richard Holbrooke brought HIV to the National Security Council during the U.S. presidency for the first time ever, right? And that would coincided with the release of the National Intelligence Estimate around the projected stability consequences of the epidemic, particularly in Eastern and Southern Africa. So there was a lot of discussion. And right before, I mean, several months before the president's State of the Union address, when the revised National Security Strategy Statement was issued in October of 2002, infectious disease was put front and center as a new form of transnational security threats. And so there was a lot of thinking going on in that period. And I think there was really a mix, an interesting mix of the moral and humanitarian and a consciousness around infectious disease as a transnational threat that could eat away economies and societies, and that required people to really think differently. Eric, what was your reflections on that?
Well, I guess I would echo the moral imperative that was, I think, in front of us. I think President Bush did see it. I think that his why it was a moral obligation was because we could. And in subsequent conversations with President Bush, he has articulated that, you know, well, why the United States? And the answer was because we could respond. I've also heard him refer to it as a reflection of kind of the conscience of the American people. And I do believe that it does reflect that. It is a talk is cheap, actions speak louder than words, which is very much an American belief and manner. And I think engaging in this does indeed carry that kind of moral authority with it. I don't think any of us who had been in Africa in the late 90s and early 2000s, in 2003, the 50,000 people in sub-Saharan Africa who were benefiting from antiretroviral therapy. Now, down the road, we are now 8 million on the planet, but, you know, 5.5, 6 to 6.3 or so in sub-Saharan Africa. A remarkable, breathtaking achievement that PEPFAR certainly contributed to with the Global Fund and with some foundation support, with convergence of World Bank and WHO and UN activity. It created a foci of activity that allowed others to be additive in a way that I think is unique and has, I think, defined a new way for us to do business in global health.
Tony, you mentioned about the skepticism you encountered from the media at that time. It reminded me in 2002 and 2003, we did some survey work here as we were setting up the task force with Senators Frist and Kerry in the Senate Task Force on HIV/AIDS. And this, and the work revealed that informed voters, American informed voters, were overwhelmingly very inclined, very receptive to the argument that the U.S. should engage at a much higher level in tackling HIV/AIDS and infectious diseases, and saw that as a national interest. Whereas media person, elite media opinion leaders, were behind that opinion in a way, lagging, and were more inclined to a kind of skeptical view. And since that time, over the last 10 years, there's been a really surprising resilience in the American opinion climate in accepting that notion and endorsing that notion. Maybe you could say a word about what is it, when you look back and you say, why would this moral imperative, ethical obligation, become such a national interest? You've offered some thoughts as to why it happened at that particular time. But also, it would be useful to hear your reflections on why is it that American opinion has been so consistently positive, even in a period of economic stress and difficulties?
Well, I'm sure there are a number of reasons. The one that springs to mind, Steve, to me, is that everybody likes a success, and everybody gets behind the success. And this was clear right from the get-go, as it was implemented, that this was saving lives, and the scientific data kept accumulating more and more. And as the time went on, it got better and better and better. And if it had been a little bit iffy, if there had been some scandals associated with it with regard to misappropriation of money, I don't think you would have seen that. But, you know, America has the conscience, as Eric said, but America also likes a winner. And this was really a winner. So there was no trouble getting everybody behind it after that. I think that, I'm sure there's other reasons, but to me, that sticks out.
And that gets us to sort of the second question, which was around reflecting on PEPFAR as a smart power tool. I mean, there's been this consensus that's formed in recent years around combining soft and hard assets to advance U.S. national interests. And PEPFAR continually figures as a very effective instrument, a soft power instrument. Can you say, Mark, tell us a little bit more about your view of how effective has that been and why?
Yeah, and it kind of gets to your earlier comment after Tony and my response, which was when you asked us why did the Bush administration do it, we told you why, but then you talked about the other conversations that were happening. That is not why President Bush acted, but that presidents don't act alone. I care deeply about what the American people believe, and as you said, as Eric said, President Bush always believed that, and I believe President Obama does as well, that something like PEPFAR represents the conscience and character of the American people, and for us to engage in these types of things, like the Marshall Plan, it's actually good for our character, reminds us of who we are. But there are 535 people whose opinion count a lot more, and they live down the street. And so you have to actually get enough of them to vote in favor of something. And there's a cadre you'll get around the moral issue, but you're not going to get to the votes you need with that alone. And so that's where the enlightened self-interest comes into play. And I think there are a couple of factors related to that. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of hard data on this, but we do have some pretty well-informed people. I actually think Secretary Gates at Defense has spoken more eloquently about the advantages of global health and development interventions than almost anyone in the development community. And President Bush often spoke about this as well, that poor, sick, uneducated people are particularly prone to fundamentalism. There's a reason Hezbollah and other organizations, or the mafia for that matter, go in and provide social services when they begin cultivating populations. And East and West Africa in particular right now are massive battlegrounds around fundamentalism. And that resonates particularly well with people, especially today, more so than it did then. If you talk to our ambassadors in East and West Africa, they don't spend most of their time on HIV, they spend most of their time on security issues. And our defense people and our national security people, as you said, going back to 2002, have talked about the need for healthy, educated, less poor societies if we're going to have a stable environment. Stable environments are not only good for political stability, they're actually awfully good for economic growth. I mean, if you look at economic growth, health, and development, the charts are superimposable and have been for many years. Now, it probably goes both ways. A healthier population is more productive, and a more productive population is able to afford better health. So it goes together, but we're in particularly difficult economic times at the moment, and Africa, for those of you who haven't seen the World Bank report, is actually projected to be the part of the world with the most sustained growth over the next 10 years. Not Asia. Africa is predicted to have the most sustained growth over the next 10 years. So if you're looking for marketplaces, you're looking for American jobs, where we're going to be selling our goods and services, we need a healthy, prosperous Africa. And if you talk to CEOs, and I've talked to global CEOs who say, you know, today I need a healthy Africa for sourcing. You can't see my sourcing, but it's coming from a lot of it's coming from Africa. In 15 years, if I'm going to meet my benchmarks for growth, which means American jobs, I need a healthy Africa because that's my marketplace. The last one, and this is where the only place we have hard data on, are how other people view us. And the Pew data, Pew polls globally of views of different countries. And the United States, 8 of 10 of the countries with the highest rating of the United States are in sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, some of them have a higher rating of America than America has of America. The other country in that 10 is Israel, which gives you a sense of, you know, how this fits in. And, you know, to put something concrete to that abstract kind of polling data, in very remote Ethiopia, where literally at 8 in the morning, 7 in the morning, it looks like 500 years ago. There's a mist over, you can't see the few electrical lines. Everyone's in white with their camels going to the call of the local church into the market. It looks like 500 years ago. So we went to a clinic there, which PEPFAR was supporting. And the head of the clinic, in a community of that size, the head of the clinic there is a pretty important person. So he's also a town elder. And I was tired and cranky as I normally am. And he kept referring to PEPFAR this, PEPFAR that, and I was being snotty. I was like, oh, what does PEPFAR mean? You know, expecting him to say the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And he said, PEPFAR means the American people care about us. And that type of consciousness and sense is good for us, for people tend to want to follow your national security policies and are also pretty receptive to your business people if they like you. And so this all comes together in a way that, but we don't have really good data on it. We need to start collecting data on it. We're working on some modeling related to that. But it is in our enlightened self-interest, and those additional arguments get us those extra votes in a lot of ways and get us from the humanitarian votes to the massive bipartisan support we currently have. We have had since the beginning. I always say, then Senator Obama, Chairman Biden, and Senator Clinton were co-sponsors of PEPFAR reauthorization. Chairman Biden is the senator who pushed it through. This has been bipartisan since day one and continues to be under President Obama. And I think it is that because of the success, but also because there's an understanding that that success translates into something real for us in enlightened self-interest.
Thank you. It's always harder to make the case in terms of evidence on the soft side of things and on the hard side, national interest, to a skeptical Congress or to a skeptical media or citizen. things have gotten tougher, Eric, in the environment on the Hill and in mm-hmm. the environment in America. How has that changed the pressure upon you to make the case for the value of these investments, of these soft power investments? How has, in the period that you have been working this, which is much different, a period of austerity, a period of contracting resource base, of polarization in terms of our own domestic environment, a certain, you know, hardening, really, of many attitudes. How's it been, how have you navigated that climate in making the case?
Well, it has been an aspect of the job I did not think I was going to be in front of. I took the position thinking that, well, I'm going to pick this up from the Mark and Tony show and move right into, like, just expansion, you know? And I was really startled to hear that that the negotiation around the resources was not only serious but severe, that the president, President Obama, Secretary Clinton were also not expecting this degree of severity. And the discussions that ensued were really along the lines of President Bush began something. I, as President Obama, want to expand and finish it. But to do that, I need to be very clear with you about where your resources begin and end as they relate to a program expansion. So maintenance and expansion, strategic expansion, not expansion across all fronts, but expansion towards what the science says, the high impact. Interventions became the predominant focus, understanding that. And thanks to our scientific colleagues and the accrual of a lot of information, we can make assumptions that are generally accurate as to what and how a drop in incidence can be more rapidly achieved. I think that having it as a priority in the Obama administration protected us to a very large degree. We were left alone while other programs all around us were cut. And I think that on a relative level, it really was the conviction of the president that kept it there, the clarity that Secretary Clinton never pulled back from, and the deep awareness that we had that the yield and gains that had been reached in PEPFAR 1, if I could use that, would be diminished rapidly if we did not make that commitment to hold the course and expand in the critical areas that were needed to further the ability to drop morbidity and mortality. I think that the new leadership on the Hill was the hardest part of it. Mm-hmm. You and I have had many conversations about this in those early in the early part of the Obama administration, where many of the people who reauthorized, PEPFAR were no longer there. Many of the original people who put it in play were gone. And people who came in not only did not know what PEPFAR was, they did not have a perception of what the AIDS epidemic was about on the planet, let alone sub-Saharan Africa. So it required a commitment to education that took a lot of the resources that we had in OGAC, in the PEPFAR program itself, to make sure that we set up a constant, steady drumbeat to engage one by one the leadership and appropriation in the Appropriations Committee in both House and Senate that allowed us to re-educate. Our ability to take individuals to show them was the best way. But otherwise, it was, trust me, you got to believe me, this is what's going on here. But gradually, and I really did see this evolve over the last 2 years, people who saw and believed began to be our strongest advocates without any prompting, because as both Tony and Mark have said, this is something that you recognize when you see it. And I think the commonality of the human experience and your awareness of it when it's in front of you is instant. And I think we saw that over and over again. So we have some extraordinarily strong bipartisan advocates now that are coming from a background that really PEPFAR, HIV, AIDS is a recent addition to their understanding of how things are on this planet, but a commitment that seems deep.
You know, it's as I think back over the last 9 years and what Tony and Mark were saying earlier about the powerful initial driving impetus around ethics and humanitarian obligation, over time, I mean, the whole literature on humanitarianism continually makes the same point, one common point, which is that humanitarian and ethical obligations are prone to fatigue and require renewal and require a refitting over time and a return to understanding and educating. And in this case, your success diminishes the perceived threat as well. Mm-hmm. So that also, you have a fatigue factor, you have a diminished threat through your own success, and it becomes a more familiar program too. So all of those things come into play, I would seem to me, quite apart from the fact that we've had a transformation in the House of Representatives of, you know, 83 member swap of seats, and fewer than half of the members in the House and Senate who voted through are now still serving. So you have this challenge, really, this challenge to reconnect it multiple ways to make your case as a very valuable tool of soft power. I think we should open. We have about 15 minutes.
Can I just
say
one thing on that? Yes. Because I think it's really important. The fatigue is not just among members of Congress. I was just talking with some folks from civil society, the advocates who got all this started, really. The same fatigue is there among civil society and the advocacy community, and that relates to leadership fatigue. And from a budgeteer's perspective, what really causes fatigue is actually heart angina, is when you look at the treatment requirement, because it just goes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So a galvanizing thing right now to get us back, I believe, is AIDS-free generation, but more importantly, the end of the epidemic. Right. And I mean that in a technical term. I don't mean eradication. I mean ending the epidemic, controlling the epidemic, which, as Eric said, we actually now have the tools to do. And that is the kind of thing people like to get around. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can shift to ending the epidemic, ultimately an AIDS-free generation, you can regenerate and regalvanize, because it's not this bottomless pit. It's not this nothing at the end of the tunnel. It actually is. We can control the worst plague since the Black Plague, right. And we have the tools to do it now. Now, it's very difficult to do. It's going to take an enormous amount of work. The challenges are enormous. But they're the same challenges that everyone threw at our faces 12 years ago when they said you couldn't start treatment. They're the exact same. Yes, there are challenges, but we can pull it all off if we trust in people and shift to that. You know, you've done an amazing thing. There's been huge success. If we stick with it, we can actually end the epidemic.
Thank you, Tony.
You know, and that's something that the 535 people down the street understand really, really well. As you know, having testified before or briefed the Congress now, we've kept count, we lost count about over 200 times that I've done that. They ask you the same question. Okay, we're gonna give you this money, but when are you gonna fix the problem? They tend to think in really sharp terminology. And you don't wanna bring it down to its simplistic thing, but what Mark just said is a version of fixing the problem. Because if you don't fix the problem, the costs are gonna continue to do that. So if you can go in and make the point, which in some respects is really what the theme of what we're going to be doing starting tomorrow evening and next week, On the one hand, we don't want to overpromise and have everybody walk out and say, okay, they got that fixed. No, it's really, you know, the reality of the possibility of the end of the AIDS pandemic and an AIDS-free generation is the beginning of where we're going. So that the end of that, whenever that's going to be, is going to be when we fix the problem. So if we can articulate when we go back to the people who are responsible for our resources, that we are on the way to fixing the problem. And if we don't fix it, the problem is going to get worse, which is what they don't want to hear. That they want the problem to go away. So that you've got to sort of talk in their real simple terms that we're trying to make the problem go away.
Thank you. I'd like to open the discussion at this point for comments and questions from the audience. And what I suggest we do is bundled together. We'll start with three different individuals. We have one person here. Please keep your comment or question very succinct, and please identify yourself. We'll bring a microphone to you. So, sir?
Thank you. I'm Tim Boyd with the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Ambassador Goosby, you spoke about the president's commitment to protecting funding for PEPFAR, but this year he actually proposed a $200 million cut to the program in his budget request, whereas the Republican House maintained it. So I was wondering if you can comment on that and speak to whether the president is going to amend that request to restore the cut. Thank you.
Thank you. We have other comments and questions? I'd like to take a couple of others. Yes, Pearl.
Hi, I'm Pearl Alice Marsh from the One Campaign. The AU has just published its roadmap. The whole question of sustainable financing has been one that's emerging in Africa. And I'd like for any of you to comment on how you see the African role in financing this over a long time, merging with what we're doing now.
Any other hands just now? Why don't we, yes, back here.
Thank you. Rashad Abdul.
Please speak up.
Rashad Abdul, UNODC in Kenya. One word you have not mentioned with which PEPFAR has achieved, it has actually encouraged and promoted human rights, because the right to health has been given to millions of people through PEPFAR. I'll give you a small example. 6 weeks ago in Mombasa, two women who 3 years ago had CT4 count of 19, today they are well and alive and kicking with CD4s of 750 and 1200, thanks to the money that PEPFAR provided to buy ARTs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's take one other. Shannon?
You don't need a microphone, Shannon.
Yeah. Well, actually, we do for the videotape.
Actually, just building on the, I think, the really resonant commentary on sort of the next phase, you know, the beginning of the end of the epidemic, and how energizing that can be to advocates, to leadership, to funding, and to innovation, the application of scientific innovation. Maybe if you could comment a little bit, the beginning of the end is really, in my mind, a global next phase. It crosses international and domestic, and so how are you seeing the dots connect in terms of re-energizing and building the next advocacy steps for this being the next global step together?
Okay, what I'd like to do is start with Eric, and then we'll go Tony and more. Eric.
Well, I think that during the Obama administration, each year's discussion focused on what we are doing and where we wanted to go. And with a country-by-country breakdown, looked at how each country would contribute or not to a trajectory of accrual in especially the treatment, care, prevention arenas. In the care, the OVC was the main focus, the PMTCT, male circumcision, moving our treatment work to incorporate everybody at 350 or less as opposed to everybody, so it's not a test and treat, it's a 350 and less focus. pediatric infections, people with co-infections with tuberculosis. We have been able to dramatically expand on every single front, 2 to 3 times the number that we have done in each prior year, and that trajectory is mapped out to continue for the next year and a half. I think that preservation of that was the paramount focus. The lives that would be saved was the metric that was used. And I think that in an economically constrained time, that those types of decisions and considerations had to be woven in to the president's final mark. In terms of Pearl's question about the African Union, this is a sentinel moment. It is a major step. I had the privilege of speaking to the African Union earlier in the, well, I guess it was last week, and had energy of the leaders of countries, the presidents of countries, really no debate, no equivocation, not should we, but how much can we commit to putting our resources toward investing in our people. And those were the terms and the way it was oriented, investing in our people. I do believe that the economic constraints, the dropping of round 11 in the Global Fund, the ICASA meeting that leadership came to, the ministers of health, reverberated to precipitate movement in what I think was a perseveration that was going on in sub-Saharan African leadership. There's a relief in it as well, because they are proud to take that step. And I believe we are at the beginning of really a very different partnership with countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where the resources of the country will be delineated explicitly and mapped as we move forward. So we truly are additive. So I'll let you guys pick up the rest.
Well, just to underscore what Eric said about the issue of resources, it isn't just what appears to be a diminution in PEPFAR funds. It's really more of a now an interdigitation between PEPFAR and the Global Fund, so that the additional resources to the Global Fund, as Eric has said, and Mark, is really now going to be used to leverage other countries like Saudi Arabia, Japan, Germany, and others to pay more into the resources of the Global Fund. So at the end of the day, it's the effect that counts, and Eric said that as well, better than anybody can. I have nothing to add about the AU. The interesting point that someone made about country ownership, I think, is really important, because right from the very beginning, it was never meant to be a perpetual donor-recipient contract. That was not what it was supposed to be. We needed to get the ball rolling with what looked like donor-recipient, but now you very rarely hear that. It's more partnerships, and partnerships change in the relative amount or weight that one partner puts in, to the point where, as you know, you're going to hear during the meeting, that there are countries that have assumed the vast majority of that responsibility on their own, which is interesting, because then it's allowed a shifting of resources to those countries that don't necessarily have the capability at this point in time mm-hmm. to assume that much responsibility. But I can tell you from the discussions way back when, before we even actually formulated completely the PEPFAR, the intention was always that we really need to get to the point where the countries will ultimately assume, to the best of their capability, the responsibilities. And that's something that was very, very clear.
Mark? I just want to build on a couple of those points, because I think it's really important. First of all, the administration significantly increased the contribution of the Global Fund, which is an extraordinary vehicle for shared responsibility, which is something that the administration has promoted. In this budget cycle. And the Global Fund is a key tool for the United States to not be the only ones out there. This is a global response that requires not only the United States, but everyone to be involved. And so that significant increase to the contribution of the fund changes the dynamic to some extent, but doesn't change the financing in a lot of ways. To the African issue, I mean, it kind of goes to that second moral underpinning to PEPFAR that President Bush always just reacted so badly to about the way an entire continent was misrepresented. You know, while the folks in New York were arguing that treatment wasn't possible, President Mohai and Joy Pumafi led a national program with support from Merck and the Gates Foundation to start a national treatment program. They didn't much care what the public experts were saying because they knew they could do it in their own country, and they did it. And you know, from the beginning, the reason PEPFAR didn't support, there were two reasons PEPFAR didn't just spread all the money out along among 120 countries, which, by the way, a lot of people told us we should do and criticized us heavily for. One was we wanted to support national scale-up, because national scale-up requires national ownership and leadership and strategic direction. You can't do national scale-up from Washington or London. You can do pilot projects from Washington and London. That's the way we've always done development. And from the beginning, President Bush talked, and I think it was for the second moral reason, about the need to switch from paternalism to partnership and development. It's what the Monterey Consensus was all about that the Bush administration led. And I think in what is another example of a beautiful bipartisan kind of handoff and evolution was the start of the partnership framework under PEPFAR, because, you know, our development infrastructure, unlike the Global Fund, which was actually created to be a country-owned system, our development structure is a very paternalistic. It has been, and shifting that culture is very difficult, very, very difficult. We are on a progress towards it. It was very clear to us that after a couple of years that even though that was the goal, our cultures and structures were not built that way. And so we designed partnership frameworks, which Pearl Alice, you remember well, because it was then codified in the reauthorization. As a means to really solidify this relationship. And I just want to make clear that the countries have always contributed an enormous amount. They've contributed the leadership, they've contributed the human potential, they've created the innovative ideas, they've created the everything that has made these programs work. PEPFAR is not a success because of us in Washington. PEPFAR is a success because of the leadership and talent and innovation of the people in Africa. And so it's always been them. But increasingly, as their economies are growing, and some have had very strong economies, with like President Mohai, where, you know, Botswana always provided more than 70% of their resources for HIV, even at the peak of PEPFAR's contribution. South Africa, 90% now. Other countries, Zambia just doubled its contributions, which Eric has been working closely with them on. And as they're growing economically, there is this sense that, and President Kagame actually said this, you know, PEPFAR was the first time anyone actually respected us enough to hold us accountable. That to and empower, and they feel that empowerment. They feel that they can now manage their own programs, and then they can fund their own programs. It's going to be a process, and it's going to be different country by country. But there is this sense, and it was at ICASA that we really felt it. But it's been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it began with the fact that it was always their programs anyway. So if it's their programming, then they feel they should be funding it. And I think that's one of the most exciting things. And I think it does relate to how we end the epidemic. And it relates to how those 535 people, and more importantly, the Office of Management and Budget, feels a little more comfortable going forward.
Thank you. We're getting late in the hour now, and I think we're going to have to bring this to a close. I want to ask just one last question and ask all three of our speakers to comment. Mark, you made reference to the authorization legislation. I mean, that has been a very, very important vehicle for defining the national interest and getting the consensus embedded and setting the directions and the targets and going forward. In the spring and into the early summer, I did a round of interviews with people kind of off the record to talk about, well, what lies ahead in terms of prospects for reauthorization. And the opinion climate was pretty overwhelming that the current political environment and the likely political environment after our next election cycle is not going to be very favorable towards getting a successful reauthorization. So the question then becomes, what are the tools that we have to renew and redefine and update the vision of U.S. national interest and strategy looking forward, in your view? I know this is a big question, but but it ties directly. It ties directly to this, to what we're trying to say here, which is the continued strategic importance and the need for a continued revisitation of what that means. Eric, can you?
Well, I would say that we've come too far to stop now, as the kind of frame. This administration is very clear that this must remain a priority, that the ground won will be lost if we do not crescendo our involvement and move to the structural needs to establish a continuity, but also a sustainable and self-correcting delivery system in each of the countries we're in. The shift from a predominance of an emergency entry and a putting a capability immediately in place, which was absolutely the mandate and the correct thing to do. We now have to work aggressively to capacitate our partner countries, ministries of health, especially at the provincial and district levels, to continue to manage, oversee, operate, monitor, and evaluate the programs. Mark's correct in that this is an iterative process and different in each country, but we are committed to that vision, and the need for PEPFAR and the programmatic footprint that it reflects to continue is greater now than it was a year ago or 10 years ago. We absolutely see that and embrace that as a commitment.
Thank you. Tony, what are the options for?
I think ditto for what Eric said, but also if you look at the psychology of the political scene in Washington, which I love and hate at the same time, that gets back to what I said a little while ago, that everybody loves a winner. So we have, let's say, the same administration or a new administration, changes in the Congress or the same Congress, you say to yourself, everybody wants to be able to take credit for something that's a success. This is a success now. If we continue it, it unequivocally will be a success. So the one of the ways, there's a lot of complicated ways, that I would sell it, I would say, okay, the curve is doing this now. We're accelerating it and we want it to do it this way. How would you like to be the president or the Congress who's there when it's like that and going down? You could take all the credit in the world if you want to do that and go for it. That's the way I would do it.
Mark, you get the last word.
Well, you know, you start with a premise that I'm not sure I entirely would concur with, which is that it was the authorization process that rallied. Pearl Alice can attest to the fact that authorization processes can be as divisive as they are rallying, and because you fight over little things that you don't necessarily have to fight over.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're going from in an appropriation cycle and providing twice a year reports on the extraordinary success, which takes a lot of footwork. I mean, you don't have a vehicle to get to the members all the time like you do in authorization, mm-hmm. but you don't have to deal with all the stuff that people want to fight about, which literally are little marginal things that mm-hmm. can wrap everyone up into a negative thing for nothing, because the mass of it is positive. So, but that puts the burden on Eric and on everyone to spend a lot of time up explaining to members, and that means we need to get over that civil society and advocacy and congressional and political kind of fatigue and regenerate it. And I don't know that you need authorization. In fact, authorization can actually be a drag on that, rather than just the positive stuff constantly coming through, the positive things about what this program has done to save lives, to reposition the view of the American people, to reinvigorate our own sense of who we are by the that invigorating our conscience and character. And I agree with Tony, talking about the end of the epidemic. And we are on a downward trajectory. If you look at the figure from UNAIDS today, it is breathtaking. And what's really remarkable to me is the inflection point on the prevention curve, because it was going up until 2003, and then it took a big decline. So we are riding a downward trajectory. And we can either, as Tony said, amplify with the tools we now have today to drive that down, not to eliminate, but to drive it down to control, or we can wait for it to come back up again. And we know it will come back up again. We know it will come back up again. And if you wait till it comes back up again, bringing it down is going to be awfully hard. It's certainly going to be more expensive, and it may not even be possible. So I think we can position this, and I think Eric's been doing this, and President Obama and Secretary Clinton have done it. And if we use this meeting and everything going forward to say, we are going to end this epidemic if we stick with it. We can rebuild that. And I don't think authorization plays a role one way or the other in that. We can do it and probably do it more effectively in much different vehicles and in much different ways, and have Africa up there leading that charge.
Thank you. Well, that's a very eloquent conclusion, and this has been really rich and inspiring, and I want to thank all three of you for all your leadership and contributions and for being with us. Please join me in thanking us.